And so you want to put it in slideshow mode, probably.
Okay, let's, here we go. I'm in slideshow mode.
Okay, so this is Chapter 23, Part 2, the European Monetary Union. And again, we see on the left the European Union, which I believe at this point is around 28 nations in Europe. They belong to the Union, but to the Monetary Union on the right, I think there's 16 or 17 of those in the EU, not everyone. And you can see they're in orange. So there's Finland, Ireland, Greece is still in there, Italy, France, Spain, Portugal, Luxembourg, Belgium, Netherlands, Germany, Czech Republic. Looks like Austria. Austria? Yep, Austria. Okay. So that's basically, we're focusing on the monetary union because we're dealing with the money, but it's impacted also by the European Union itself, which has governing institutions that interact and have some control over the European Central Bank. Okay. So, Ann, why don't you do the six...
Again, the themes of the Law Science of Money book. Number one, primary importance of the money power, the power to create money and regulate it. Number two, the nature of money purposely kept secret and confused. Three, how a society defines money determines who controls the society. Four, battle over control of money has raged for millennia, public versus private. The misuse of the monetary system causes tremendous misery and suffering for ordinary people, and that's William Martin. Six, whenever the public has owned a significant fraction of the money power, great public benefit has ensued, such as Sparta, the Roman Republic, the American colonies in the 18th century, greenbacks after the Civil War, Canada after the Great Depression, British experience after World War II, and that's Martin's observation.
And I have no explanation of why none of this was taught to me in my education. None of it. None of it. God, just...
If you want money, you have to go to a bank, a private bank.
That's right.
So the part one, the fractional reserve problem. Two, the 100% reserve solution. Three, the ECB, central bank, and creating reserves and new money. Four, regarding Great Britain, the euro and the problem of Europe. Five, accountability and institutionalize a formal review process. Six, Greece, Eurozone sovereign debt crisis. Seven, stated goals and comment. Eight, political influence blocked and a comment. Nine, likely outcome, and that comes from the fact that Stephen's book was published in 2002, when the euro was only 3 years old. So he was trying to project. 10 is some conclusions. 11, conflict with Europe. And 12, the euro results thus far. So that's what we'll cover in part two.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll do the first one. The fractional reserve problem. The European Central Bank allows banks to engage in fractional reserve banking. This shifts power to the private banks to control economies. And that picture is from a study that was done in Europe. And it identified 146 top institutions in the core of the world economy that control 40% of the value of transnational corporations. Of those 146 institutions that control all of this, most of them are banking institutions. And there's a website you can go and read about it, and there's also a TED Talk. One of the investigators who wrote this study went on a TED Talk, and you can listen on YouTube to him talking about this study. He's very good. I like him when I hear him talk. He's very down to earth and direct. And to the right are the 20 of the 50 top corporate owners in the world. This was worldwide influence over the economies. So we have Barclays, number one. Isn't that English?
It's a bank.
In England, right?
Yeah.
Barclays, Capital Group Companies, some of these I've never heard of.
No.
FMR Corporation.
AXA is, it's mostly an annuity company. AXA Equitable, insurance annuity products.
It's French, right? I think it's French.
Yeah, I think you're right.
State Street Corporation. Very interesting how State Street shows
State Street,
up.
The financial product, investing. Yeah.
Yes, but it's also very connected to investment coming out of crises. State Street is always there's always State Street talked about when there's like bailouts and stuff. So I always wonder about them. J.P. Morgan Chase and Company, Legal and General Group PLC, Vanguard Group, UBS. United Bank of Switzerland.
And Vanguard, we know, is virtually a nonprofit.
Well, it's in this list.
Well, it doesn't matter. The list is including nonprofit.
I'm not sure what a nonprofit is doing in this list.
Well, Vanguard Group, their founding principle was, why should we make investors pay enormous commissions and fees on their investments when if they own the company like mutual insurance companies and so on, we can keep the fee, we can do all index funds. All the funds will be indexed, which require no fund manager. So you don't have to pay a high-priced fund manager. Then we charge minuscule fees that just cover our overhead. And then the little guy makes it big because they're not paying all these extra charges.
Right, but the control of the shares that are invested by Vanguard is impacting the world economy.
Well, Vanguard invests in all these. Right. They have huge index funds that include the world's biggest and some of the smallest companies.
And that's why they're on this list.
Yeah,
they're actually number eight.
But they, you know, once Vanguard got its toe in the water, the fees of Fidelity went down. They had to completely reorganize the company.
Right, but that's looking from a very narrow viewpoint of fees.
Yeah.
This study is looking at control. Who's controlling?
Who's controlling? Yeah, well, they're buying companies who are controlled by who knows.
Yeah. UBS, Merrill Lynch and Company. Let me change that. Merrill Lynch and Company. Wellington Management, never heard of them.
They are like a mutual fund company, mostly, and Vanguard buys some of their funds.
Okay. Deutsche Bank, we have all heard of that. Franklin Resources, Credit Suisse Group, Walton Enterprises, a holding company for the Walmart heirs, they're number 15. Woo! Bank of New York Mellon, Natixis, Goldman Sachs, T. Rowe Price Group, and Legg Mason. These are the top 20.
Yeah, T. Rowe Price and Legg Mason are basically T. Rowe Price is a no-fee mutual company. So, they give you bargain investments like Vanguard. Legg Mason is totally for-profit to finance financial services investments.
Yeah. Well, even if they don't charge any fees, they control their
I did a
control.
Big job for them one time, Legg Mason. Communications.
Okay.
And they were...
And
okay.
Will, do the next one. I should write this down.
Okay. The ECB allows banks to engage in fractional reserve banking. Fractional reserve banking is a privilege to private banks leads to the continued concentration of wealth and power into the hands of the bankers. And it shows, you've got a drawing, shows that octopus banking, the banking system involved in everything. Transportation, farms, politicians, TV and radio, oil, everything, and in the industry. The bankers are in everything. Newspapers, magazines.
Yeah, the debt money, the loans. Loans and debt money, because that's what our system is.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why there's that octopus with the evil-looking eyes.
All in debt to them.
Absolutely. Everything is debt. Yeah. And the next one.
The ECB allows banks to engage in fractional reserve banking. Fractional reserve banking as a privilege to the private banks is a source of panics and crashes in money and banking markets. And there we see this famous photograph taken during the Great Depression in the U.S.
Wow.
Of a starving family.
Well, they're hardly covered, right? Hardly getting their basic needs met.
Yep.
Do the next one too.
Fractional reserve banking as a privilege to the private banks is a source of panics and crashes in money and banking markets. Again, so we see the Great Depression in Europe with people being turned away, I guess, at the banks.
Yeah. Affected worldwide the system. I'll do the next one. The 100% reserve solution. 100% reserves could be implemented, but the European bankers would prefer fractional reserve banking under their old national systems instead of 100% reserves in the European community, said Steve Zarlenga in his book. And there is a program for monetary reform. This was the paper that was written by these six economists, and in 1939 they sent it around to around 1,000 economists in the United States, and around 220 of them agreed with these six economists. All of these six economists at that time were very well known and respected. Paul Douglas, the University of Chicago.
Yale, Duke, yeah.
Irving Fisher was at Yale. Frank Graham was Princeton. Earl Hamilton was Duke, Wilfred King was NYU, and Charles Whittlesey, Princeton. And it was not instituted by our federal government. Roosevelt had a copy of it, he sent a copy of it.
The paper was just called Program for Monetary Reform.
Yes.
But is this what we call the 100% net reserve plan?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
We'll do the next one.
Okay. Let's see, I gotta get that out of the way here. The 100% reserve solution, then. The follow-up proposal was put forward by American economists in 1939 as an alternative to the private fractional reserve bank system. A program for monetary reform in 1939 and then it's by Paul Douglas, Irving Fisher, Frank Graham, Earl J. Hamilton, Wilford I. Keane, and Charles R. Whittlesey. It is desirable that any bank or other agency holding deposits subject to check demand deposits required to keep on hand a dollar of reserve for every dollar of such deposit, so that in effect deposits subject to check annually actually represent money held by the bank in trust for the depositor.
So the legal definition of money was very different under this plan, because the money was held in trust and was still owned by the depositor.
Is that what's called the 100% reserve system? That for all the money you have in there is they have in the bank?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. And that's another good question for Occupy Wall Street. When you deposit your money in the bank, is it still yours? Because it's not.
Yeah, is your bank still there?
Oh yeah, that is a good question.
Yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. People think that's their money.
Yeah. And they think their money is still in the bank.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, that'd be a good question. We'll do that one.
That's very surprising when you find out you don't own it anymore. Then you get a little nervous.
Yeah.
The fractional reserve system, 9, a chief loose screw in our present American money and banking system is the requirement of only fractional reserves behind demand deposits. Fractional reserves give our thousands of commercial banks the power to increase or decrease the volume of our circulating medium by increasing or decreasing bank loans and investments. The banks thus exercise what has always and justly been considered a prerogative of sovereign power. And that's from a program for monetary reform, 1939. The 100% reserve system was the original system of deposit banking, but the fractional reserve system was introduced by private Venetian bankers no later than the middle of the 14th century. But what thus began as a breach of trust has now become the accepted and lawful practice. 13. The 100% reserve requirement would, in effect, completely separate from banking the power to issue money. The two are now disastrously interdependent. Banking would become wholly a business of lending and investing pre-existing money.
Okay. Next, number 3, the ECB and creating reserves and new money. Here's Stephen. It would negate much of the ultimate purpose of the European Central Bank to rely on fractional reserve banking as its main method of creating money. The ECB needs the ability to do that independently and directly. It needs the ability to create reserves or simply money out of thin air when it determines that is the best way to monetarily serve the community. Page 638. And here's a cartoon. On the top is an ATM machine, and the woman is saying to her child, "Money doesn't just come out of a wall. It's a lot more complicated than that." And then the child is looking behind the ATM machine.
Are you sure?
Oh, boy. Oh, boy. We'll do the next one.
Okay. Yeah, this is from Zerling, yeah, on page 638. Yet there is not sufficient reference to the ECB's power to create reserves or its intended use in the ECB protocols. They are like temple priests bowing low to the ground in the presence of the Holy of Holies, afraid or forbidden to even to look directly at the power.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. I just had this thought as you were reading that. The fact that it's not explicitly stated in the protocols, right? The protocols of the Maastricht Treaty, is very worrisome, because again, it's this deception. Let's not be specific about what money is or where it comes from or who has the power to create it. To keep it that, you know.
Maastricht Treaty, aka Treaty on Economic Community from Protocols creating ECB. Article 12, responsibilities of the decision-making bodies. The governing council shall adopt the guidelines and take the decisions necessary to ensure the performance of tasks entrusted to the ESCB under this treaty and this statute. The governing council shall formulate the monetary policy of the community, including as appropriate decisions relating to intermediate monetary objectives, key interest rates, supply of reserves in the ESCB, and shall establish the necessary guidelines for their implementation. Oh my God. What does that all mean?
Well, they're keeping it vague. But the governing council is one of the three institutions in the European Central Bank, right, that makes decisions. And according to this, it formulates monetary policy. And they're saying that means objectives, key interest rates, supply of reserves. But they're not being very specific about it.
Yeah.
Which is worrisome. And do the next one.
Because the Bundesbank previously relied heavily on trade surpluses to obtain U.S. dollar monetary reserves, perhaps there is a hope of continuing to do this with the ECB. Selling more than you buy creates friction with your trading partners. It is a mentality that treats the money system like a game of marbles. So let's see, in the cartoon, this guy is holding up a banner saying free trade, and Wall Street is crushed, and this donkey or whatever he is says, somehow I thought scaling the heights of capitalism would feel like more of an achievement.
Yeah, free trade becomes a war. This is not really free when the countries are so not equal. Remember when we were talking about the trading, how the response of Bretton Woods and the Americans was to build a system. Well, if you're a country and you get into trouble trading, well, we'll give you a loan. That was their solution.
Yeah.
Knowing that those countries would never be able to pay off those loans.
And what was the statement about how does a system of trade work? What does it take for it to work well? And it can't work well if one party cannot trade on the level of the other party.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was the proponent of the alternative to Bretton Woods was Keynes, John Maynard Keynes. And he said, we don't want free trade, we want balanced trade.
Balanced trade, yeah.
So if you have more exports, if you're a country with more exports, then you want to import from those countries that have less exports and import from them. So it would be balanced.
Yeah, if you don't do it, then there's bad news.
Yeah, yeah, well then
they said the treaty said, no, we're going to loan them money.
That's it. That was their, what they wanted, what the Americans wanted.
Yeah.
They wanted debt controls, you know. That's debt is a weapon. What is it Napoleon said? The hand that gives is above the hand that takes. And, you know, the creditor is the hand that gives, and the borrower is the hand that takes.
And China just devalued its currency so that it can export more.
Oh.
Yeah. This is very big. I mean, they want their goods to be affordable here. Well, they've been too affordable here. But I guess there are poorer countries that they would like to have buy their goods, so they have to charge them less in a sense.
Well, actually, I went with a friend from work to a shopping center on Friday. She was looking for some clothes, and all the clothes were from Indonesia,
mm-hmm. Malaysia,
not China. So China must be feeling the effect of that. Those countries in Asia are even being paid less than what the Chinese are paying their labor.
Yes.
They're being paid less and less and less in this system. Yeah. Okay, I'll do the next one. Europeans should remember that the ESCB, and that's the European System of Central Banks, that's all the central banks, not only in the 16 or 17 Eurozone countries, but the other countries that use their own currency within the European community. Okay, that's the ESCB. That the ESCB contains a monetary power to help make the economy flourish, not merely to grow. It can be used when there is the will to do it. They need to stop acting as facilitators for international currency speculation, which can only destroy. And I just have to say, I didn't know any of this history about speculation. And of course, it started really big time after the world went off the gold standard in 1971, right? But I'm just aghast that these countries let these speculators move all these millions of dollars around and just destroy economies.
Well, remember what was his name after World War I in Germany? That he allowed currency speculation and it destroyed the German currency.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that's allowed.
Yeah.
You know. And you see on the left, you see the
mice or the rats.
Well, yeah, on the right are the rats, which are the speculators, right? At, you know, going after the euro. It'll go after anything. And they're allowed to do it. Mm-hmm. It's just beyond me that people who are in, well, I guess the wrong people are in charge of the system. Tell me if it's too cold for you.
I'm good.
Are you good?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, let me. So, Will, you're next.
The recent monetary debacle of Southeast Asian countries in 1997 through 98 has demonstrated the danger of basing one's economy on a money system and monetary unit that someone else controls. Today, 2002, the Indonesian government is still in tatters. This experience highlights a system of unlimited free trade in currencies and the resultant mobilization of billions of dollars that can be deployed and with no advance notice at the speed of light.
What would be an example of doing that, you know, unlimited free trade in currencies and billions of dollars, you know, in a flash? Do we know any examples of what that looks like?
I don't know specific trades.
Yeah.
But selling a country's currency. So, these countries were Malaysia, Philippines, Thailand. So it's either, and other people say what you think. So investors go into the country and they say, oh, well, we'll invest our money in Thailand. And I'll go in and I'll put my money in these shares for these companies in this sector of the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And then a year later they go, oh, you know what? I can make more money over in China. So they sell their shares and they pull out.
So they're pulling the chair out from under the person.
Out of the country. Yeah, the economy of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a good question, you know, to get some very specifics about it, specific trades that were done.
Yeah.
Because these are very, very large trades.
And they're... And the concepts are a little abstract.
Yes.
You need to be able to think about what would somebody be doing.
So I'll do some research on the Southeast Asian debacle and see if I can get...
What happened? All these people in the picture on the right are all left out of all that.
Oh, yeah.
They're just left out. They're not part of it.
Yeah.
In the buildings back there are.
Ah, which is one.
I look at that picture on the right of the people living in poverty and I remember what the Comer president up in Canada said. She said, poverty is a crime. It's a crime. It's a criminal act to have that happen. It's true. When you know about the money system, you know.
You know that it's inflicted on the people. It's not something wrong with the people.
That's right.
You know, in the Bible, Jesus said, you will always have the poor. But he didn't mean because the bankers will make it impossible for anybody to get ahead. He meant people that were ill.
Next one.
The ECB and creating reserves and new money. The European Central Bank can be strong enough to keep the monetary manipulators at bay. Combined with further measures such as denial of visas and even arrest warrants against those in the corporate chain of command of offending organizations. That's our lingo.
I like Steve. I like him just saying that, you know.
Yeah.
Just put him in jail. It's a crime.
And the articles, where in exceptional circumstances, movements of capital to or from third countries cause or threaten to cause serious difficulties for the operation of economic and monetary union, the Council, acting by a qualified majority on a proposal from the Commission and after consulting the ECB, may take safeguard measures with regard to third countries for a period not exceeding 6 months if such measures are strictly necessary. So this is... Here's how they have the authority.
Yes.
To keep the manipulators at bay.
Yes.
And then here's Article 73G. If in the cases envisaged in Article 228A, action by the community is deemed necessary, the Council may, in accordance with the procedure provided for in Article 228A, take the necessary urgent measures on the movement of capital and on payments as regards the third countries concerned. Then two, without prejudice to Article 224, and as long as the Council has not taken measures pursuant to paragraph 1, a member state may, for serious political reasons and on grounds of urgency, take unilateral measures against a third country with regard to capital movements and payments.
Yeah, like they could, a country could go in and stop those transactions.
Yeah.
You know, this is attacking our economy.
Then in the Maastricht Treaty, aka Treaty on European Union, 1993. In this treaty, non-monetary institutions were identified for the European Union. And those are the European Parliament, the Council, which is the Council of Ministers, European Commission, Court of Justice of the EU, Court of Auditors of the EU, and European Council. So certain of those are legislative and others are executive.
Right. So in these articles 73F and 73G, when they say council, they're talking about this council of the
other ministers.
EU.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I put that there.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll do the next one. Regarding Great Britain, the euro and the problem with Europe. Integrating Britain into the European monetary system can help resolve a three-centuries-old problem that has plagued the world. That's Stephen, page 641. Here's a quote from Carol Quigley, Tragedy and Hope, published in 1966. This is like a 1,400-page book. The central problem of Europe remains today, as it has for a century, the problem of Germany. And today, as before, this problem cannot be solved without Britain. But such a solution requires that Britain accept the fact that it is a European and not a world or even an Atlantic power. This, the leaders of Britain and the American branch of the British establishment have been unwilling to accept. As a consequence, Britain remains aloof from the continent, committed to the Atlantic community. And he wrote another book called The Anglo-American Establishment, also. He actually worked with a lot of the very high-level financiers and knew exactly what they were thinking and doing.
Uh-huh.
So, but he was an academic. I forget what foundation he worked for. So he understood, you know, how they thought and, you know, why they were doing things. he left to go back to academia, and he wrote this book, Tragedy and Hope, and the response when he published it was they got really mad at him because they were on the assumption you don't talk about this stuff. And he said, I was surprised, you know. He said, I believe in what they're doing. So I was just, you know, sharing it because I believed in it. But
I didn't understand the first sentence. The problem, central problem of Europe is for a century been Germany.
And the power of Germany, the economic power of Germany, and then competing with Britain.
The central problem of Europe, okay. And then today, it has to be solved can't be solved without Britain, because Britain is strong enough to go up against Germany.
Right, well, that's First World War and the Second World
but
War.
But a solution requires Britain. So the fact that it's a little bit unequal with them, with those European countries, and they say, no, we're better.
Right, and Britain never joined the European Euro community.
No.
Yeah. No. And do the next one.
Integrating Britain into the European monetary system can help resolve a three centuries old problem that has plagued the world. This is Carol Quigley again. The more moderate roundtable group sought, above all, to free Britain from Europe in order to build up an Atlantic bloc of Great Britain, the British Dominions, and the United States. They prepared the way for this union through the Rhodes Scholarship Organization, through the roundtable groups which had been set up in the United States, India, and the British Dominions in 1910 and 1917, through the Chatham House Organization, which set up Royal Institute of International Affairs in all the Dominions, and a Council on Foreign Relations in New York. So, this is how...
What year? Well, here, we got Martin.
Hey!
Hey, hi.
1966, oh yeah.
Hi.
We're talking about.
Hi there.
Hi. Good to see you.
Now this is, the next quote is from Wikipedia?
Yes.
Okay. Writing in 2009, the Secretary of the Rhodes Trust criticized the trend of Rhodes scholars to pursue careers on Wall Street. Does that surprise me that they were doing that? Noting that more than twice as many now went into business in just 1 year than did in the entire 1970s, attributing it to the grotesque wages offered by such occupations. That is true. That is absolutely true. Bill Clinton was a Rhodes Scholar.
That's right.
And he became president. Okay, indeed in the 1990s, at least a half dozen Rhodes Scholars would serve as partners at Goldman Sachs, and since the 1980s, McKinsey and Company has had a dozen or more Rhodes Scholars.
So
I've spent the most of my life in physics departments, and a tremendous number of people who are doing PhDs in physics went off to the City of London or off to Wall Street. They hired an enormous number of physicists and mathematicians.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people just went off there, and I met them again, and they were earning a tremendous amount of money.
Yes. That's where the money was, is still.
So they're educating people to support the current system is what's happened.
That's right. To support the power, the money power structure.
So you're not going to get a Rhodes Scholar writing a paper about alternatives to the system.
No. Nope.
And on the right?
On the right is the, you see the building, that nice looking building? I can't recognize where it's located, but it's the Council on Foreign Relations in New York.
I think that's Park Avenue. One of those streets is Park Avenue. Yeah. Nice building.
On the east side.
Yep.
What are they doing there?
The Council on Foreign Relations?
Yeah.
I don't know.
They publish a lot of studies. A lot of studies. There's a lot of publishing going on there. Martin, do the next one.
Actually, my tongue is problematic. Do you mind if I pass?
Oh, okay, sure. I'll do the next one. Regarding Great Britain, the euro, and the problem of Europe. In a public speech in April 2015, Anne Emmett, the president of the Canadian Monetary Reform Group, COMER, said that the executive branch, this is Canada, stopped giving interest and low-interest loans from the publicly owned Bank of Canada after attending a meeting in 1974 at the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements. COMER's lawsuit would force the executive branch to again begin using the bank to fund Canadian infrastructure projects, similar to the period 1938 to 1974. During this time, Canada got its free higher public education, national railroad system, public health care system, etc. And here's a quote again from Carol Quigley in Tragedy and Hope, published 1966. The powers of financial capitalism had another far-reaching aim, nothing less than to create a world system of financial control in private hands, able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole. This system was to be controlled in a feudalist fashion by the central bankers of the world, acting in concert by secret agreements, arrived at in frequent private meetings and conferences. The apex of the system was the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, private bank owned and controlled by the world central banks, which were themselves private corporations. The growth of financial capitalism made possible a centralization of world economic control and use of this power for the direct benefit of financiers and the indirect injury of all other economic groups. So that BIS is one effect you can see right up there in Canada, what happened up there. Very powerful effect. Now the Canadian government is huge debt, and the people of Canada are paying huge amounts of interest every year on that debt, which they didn't have before 1973, before that meeting at the BIS.
Mm-hmm. Now, by the way, I was watching some of the Republican candidates speaking at the Iowa Fair yesterday. I think it was yesterday, and I heard Bernie Sanders. And he gets up and he says, we should have free higher education and we should have free this. And his ideas sounded ridiculous. You know, where's the money coming from? You know, who's going to pay for that? What a stupid man. And, you know, he didn't say where the money would come from.
I want him to say where the money's going to come
from. Maybe he doesn't know that there's an alternative.
Well, he must have some idea how he's going to pay for all this.
Well, maybe we have to teach him about the NEED Act, you know, monetary reform, and the Canadian system, and what they did on a public banking system.
James Galbraith is one of his economic advisors.
Oh.
And so he might actually be more aware of monetary matters than he lets on in public.
Because he just sounded like an idiot at the fair. You know, pie in the sky ideas, how ridiculous.
Wow, that's very interesting.
Because he doesn't say how he's going to do it. Or how
Jeremy Corbyn, who looks likely to get the Labour Party leadership in the UK, and if the Labour Party win the next election, would become the next Prime Minister, is very much like Bernie Sanders. And he's quite explicit about it. He's basically going to have the Bank of England print money for them to spend directly. And the argument is, look, we had QE, gave all this money to the bankers, there's no inflation, why can't we do this for the ordinary?
What's his name?
Jeremy Corbyn.
Jeremy Corbyn.
I actually knew him when I was a graduate student.
How did you know him?
He was doing a master's degree in theoretical physics at Imperial College in London.
Huh.
But what he was really interested in was radical politics.
Well, I'm glad he's talking about who's creating money.
So they're basically saying, look, we created these trillions for the banks and whatever, and we haven't had inflation. We can create trillions for ordinary folk.
Good for him.
Uh-huh.
It's a relief to hear someone just say it.
Yeah, we have to help Bernie Sanders. He's not saying right things. He just sounds laughable.
I agree with you there. He's not being explicit about where the money is going to come from.
Yeah. You know, so I think it's tougher in the United States to talk about it than in Britain. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Will, do the next one.
Still on the euro and the prop here. From BB Monetary Reformer. Who? Who's BB?
Somebody I know.
Okay.
Someone who doesn't want to disclose their name.
I don't want to disclose their name. I don't have their permission.
Oh, okay. July the 4th, 2015. Subject, Greece, to consider bank disclosures,
bank closures,
and control of money. they, Great Britain, dropped out of the EMS, European Monetary System, back in about 1992. George Soros is blaming for taking them out when he shortened the pound with hot money.
Shorted.
Yeah. Okay, the owners of the corporation of the City of London never would have stood for giving up their currency so they could create debt bubbles.
Isn't that an example of how individuals or foreign countries or something shouldn't be allowed to manipulate a currency?
Sure, absolutely. But
do you have a picture of the City of London? British Financial Center. It's unique in the UK and has some unusual responsibilities for a local council, such as being the police authority.
Yeah, the financiers have their own police authority, local policemen.
The City of London is a quasi-independent state within Great Britain.
It's quasi-independent? Really?
Yeah. It has a lot of independence from the rest of the UK. Look at where the hell it belongs.
Wow. I didn't know that. I think it gets worse and worse, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, it's like sort of equivalent to the BIS having that charter from Switzerland that says the Swiss police have no authority.
Yeah.
And you can't... you know, demand anything from us, to see anything from us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And do the next one.
Accountability and institutionalize a formal review process. Maastricht Treaty, aka Treaty on European Union, Protocol on the Statute of the European System of Central Banks and of the European Central Bank, Article 35. Judicial control and related matters. Article, this is 35.1. The acts or omissions of the ECB shall be open to review or interpretation by the Court of Justice in the cases and under the conditions laid down in this treaty. The ECB may institute proceedings in the cases and under the conditions laid down in this treaty. And here we have from Stephen, presumably not providing an adequate money supply sufficient for industry and commerce would be an omission.
That would, you could bring a case in the Court of Justice.
Yeah, that's constituting an omission. Yeah, the acts are omissions. Okay.
And the Court of Justice is an institution in the European community,
right.
European Union.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I'll do the next one. Member nations of the Eurozone are responsible for their own budget, tax revenues coming in, and government spending going out. When tax revenues do not cover government spending, individual countries need to sell their government bonds in the open market to raise money. And there's a picture on the left. Greek bonds look uglier and uglier. Inverted yield curve shows nobody wants Greek debt.
So basically when tax revenues don't cover government spending, then the country is supposed to sell their bonds. However, their bonds look ugly. When they're in that kind of a shape, nobody's going to want to buy their bonds.
That's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened. Yep.
Yield on the 10-year German government.
So remember, in the Eurozone, everybody's using the euro, which is under the control of the ECB and the ECB Council and you know the executive branch. So the individual central banks in the Eurozone countries, they can't create money. They can't create reserves or do anything like that. They have to sell, the countries have to sell their government bonds and raise money through debt. Raise money through debt. Okay, and over on the right is another example of a Eurozone country, Germany, selling its government bonds. And this is simply a the yield to the creditors who buy the bonds, how much they're going to get. So these countries have to sell bonds and go into debt if they need money. Will, do the next one.
Institutionalize a formal review process. In 2010, sovereign debt crisis, usually when governments have difficulty selling their bonds, the central bank of that country intervenes to buy government bonds, created reserves. But the ECB made it very clear to markets it will not do this. So countries in the Eurozone have no lender of last resort. While the ECB can supply large amounts of liquidity reserves through both open market operations and lending to individual banks. In 2008, it was hesitant to supply liquidity during the sovereign crisis of 2010. Okay. Now, you have a chart on the left. Selected EU debt 2007 through 2010, and it looks like you have the European area as a whole, Germany, Ireland, Greece,
Spain.
Between the green and the blue, that was the green 2007?
Yes.
What is that?
Yes. Look at the bottom left.
Just a second. Green is debt in 2007, blue is debt in 2010. Okay. So you have Ireland, Greece, Spain, France, Portugal, United Kingdom.
Look at Ireland. Bad shape.
Oh my goodness, look at Ireland.
Huge debt.
Yeah.
But it's still under 100% of their GDP. Greece is above.
Greece started out high, but higher.
Yeah, and it's even higher now. But everybody is suffering from this debt crisis, all these countries.
Yes.
Read at the bottom, Will.
Oh, the most useful guide to levels of manageable debt is debt to GDP ratio. Therefore, a fall in GDP and a rise of debt means this will rise rapidly.
Right, because at the same time that GDP is falling, you know, there's less going on in your economy, mm-hmm. you have to borrow more, so the debt is rising, so it's a double whammy.
Yeah. So here in this first paragraph, if they have trouble selling their bonds, central bank intervenes to buy bonds with created reserves. Is that kind of like what we did here with our?
Yes.
The Treasury buying our bonds. Yeah.
The Federal Reserve will always be the lender of last resort, though they didn't do that during the Great Depression, so we had the Great Depression.
Yes.
But today they will do that. And that's not true in the Eurozone countries. They've given up their sovereignty over their money. They can't do that.
So that being the case, what about this British guy we were just reading about? I forget his name.
Keynes?
No. The one, it was a photograph and his whole...
Carol Quigley. He's American, by the way.
Oh, he's American.
Yeah. But he wrote about the Anglo-British...
Well, in this case, isn't Britain much better off to have control of sovereignty over their currency?
You would think.
Yes.
What do you think, Will and Martin?
British government debts at the moment, they're still selling bonds for very, 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 very low rates, whereas, I mean, the rates on the French government debt are much higher,
wow.
Portugal higher. Britain's got its own currency, and yields on British bonds are still very low, in contrast to most of these other countries. Britain's bond yields are on a par with Germany's because it has its own currency.
But that's a good question that Anne brings up in terms of the Eurozone and the European Central Bank. These countries have given up their sovereignty over their money. And once you do that,
you're done.
I mean, is the Eurozone a good idea?
Well, we just read that he who doesn't control his sovereignty over his money loses power, has no power.
That's right.
So.
Yeah, I mean, it's also worse than that in the Eurozone because here in the US you have Chapter 9 bankruptcy for cities and states if needed. Then you get Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection from creditors. In Europe, there is no similar thing at all, and Greece is being killed right now. There is no protection like Chapter 9 bankruptcy in Europe.
So no, you can get rid of your debts under certain circumstances. A debt jubilee under certain circumstances. Wow. That's hard.
If Greece was an American state, say New Hampshire, for example, Greece would be in Chapter 9 bankruptcy protection right now. But Greece, as a member of the Eurozone, can't do that, or anything like it.
Yeah. And do the next one.
2012 OMT, ECB's government bond buying program. The European Central Bank's outright monetary transactions, that's OMT, or bond buying program, was announced by Mario Draghi, president of the ECB, in September 2012. The ECB has indicated that through OMT, it is willing to purchase unlimited quantities of government debt with maturities between 1 and 3 years. The size of the program is unlimited, lending credence to Mr. Draghi's remarks that he would do whatever it takes, quote, to save the euro. Mr. Draghi stressed that any purchases under the OMT would be subject to strict and effective fiscal conditions, most likely to take the form of austerity measures and structural reforms. The prior bond buying program, the Securities Markets Program, or SMP, was both limited in its scope and unconditional. Now, usually when it becomes difficult for a country to sell its government debt, the central bank of that country intervenes to buy government bonds. By creating OMT, the ECB has acknowledged that Eurozone governments need a lender of last resort. So here we are. We have Mario Draghi is eyeing Mount Everest there with his pick, and he's standing on the European Central Bank, and this huge mountain is expectations on saving the euro. He thinks that's going to help save the euro, and it doesn't look like he's going to get too far.
Well, he supposedly has this OMT.
Outright Monetary Transactions or Bond Buying Program.
Yep. On to the next one. June 16th, 2015, the European Court of Justice declares OMT legal. German plaintiffs took the OMT plan to court, arguing that the ECB overstepped its mandate and that it constituted monetary financing of governments, which is forbidden under EU law. The German Constitutional Court referred the case to the European Court of Justice, the EU's top court. And this is their summary. Court of Justice of the European Union. This is their press release. The OMT program announced by the ECB in September 2012 is compatible with EU law. This program for the purchase of government bonds on secondary markets does not exceed the powers of the ECB in relation to monetary policy and does not contravene the prohibition of monetary financing of member states. So he was ECB has now has this power by law.
So they will have a debt bubble like us.
Well, right? They haven't used this yet.
Oh, they haven't. Mm-hmm.
It's just there as to be used.
Potential, okay.
Yeah. But remember, any of these bond buying programs of a Eurozone country comes with structural adjustments. You know, it's, they have to cut their expenses, you know, tax more. Mm-hmm.
In other words, austerity.
Austerity, right. And if you hit the enter key, it says OMT has never been used so far. So far.
Yeah.
We'll do the next one.
Okay.
MU is making these decisions. Who is the EU? Who in the EU? By the spring of 2010, Greece was veering toward bankruptcy, which threatened to set off a new financial crisis. To avert calamity, so-called Troika, the IMF, the ECB, and the European Commission issued the first of two international bailouts for Greece, which would eventually total more than 240 billion euros. The bailout came with conditions. Lenders imposed harsh austerity terms, requiring deep budget cuts and steep tax increases.
Well, I mean, if you want to use debt as a weapon against whole people, you know.
There it is.
Wow. I was listening to a video of a Greek family, and because of the conditions in Greece, because of this austerity, the government raised the tax on house heating oil 450%. So people have stopped buying oil and are going and getting wood. And they're using wood to heat their
houses.
Well,
they don't have too many trees in Greece.
Yeah, Greece doesn't have any trees.
I know.
They can't manufacture furniture because they don't have enough wood.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have people who work for the government that go out into the countryside to stop people from cutting down the little wood that's there.
Yeah.
I mean, this is...
It's very bad. Well, you know, Greece does have an awful lot of sunshine. Maybe somebody ought to donate solar panels.
Yes.
Seriously, I mean, they'd be sitting pretty if they had solar panels.
I've been to Greece. There are solar panels there.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if people can afford them at this point.
Yeah, that's the problem, is affordability.
You know. We'll do the next one.
Chart to the left, Greek government debt. And then we'll get into that in a second. Almost two thirds, almost two thirds of the Greek's debt, about 200 billion euros, is owed to the Eurozone bailout fund or other Eurozone countries. Greece does not have to make any payments on the debt until 2020. The International Monetary Fund has proposed extending the grace period into mid-century. In the short term, though, Greece has a problem making payments due on loans from the IMF and on the bonds held by the ECB. Those obligations amount to more than 24 billion euros. through the middle of 2018, and it is unlikely that either institution would agree to the long debt delays in repayment. Are the debts debt money? And if so, what banks created them?
Right, I'm going to make a correction. On the chart, you see the pink arrow that says IMF?
Yeah.
And it's pointing to 24 billion euro debt by Greece to the IMF. The other green arrow should say ECB. And those are bonds held by the central bank, 27 billion dollar euros worth. Yeah.
Okay.
So we've learned that the International Monetary Fund can actually create debt money. We learned that a couple of classes ago. And the ECB, held by the ECB, I guess, you know, they created reserves to buy those bonds from the Euro countries. But I believe, I put these questions in there because I believe if you really look at where the money is coming from for all of the debts, ultimately the money itself pretty much is always being created by private banks that are either buying bonds or whatever.
Well, I'm just wondering, is Spain loaning them money? Spain doesn't have money to loan.
That's true. What are these countries own? The countries themselves own the Greek bonds, or is it creditors in the country, many of them private banks, who created debt money out of thin air in order to buy the bonds?
My understanding is that the governments took out loans from the private banks to give that money to Greece. So in other words, it is the national governments of these countries that are on the hook for it. The banks created the money, but the governments are on the hook for it.
Right. So are the governments guaranteeing the loans?
The idea, yeah.
Yeah. So the banks themselves actually have these bonds that are guaranteed by France, Germany, Italy, Spain, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. So in order to buy those bonds, those banks created money out of thin air.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. To bludgeon the Greeks with this debt. And do the next one.
The Deal for Greece, July 2015. A European Commission spokeswoman said a technical deal had been reached last night between parties including Greece, the IMF, the ECB, and the European Stability Mechanism. In exchange for funding worth up to 86 billion euros, that's $94 billion, Greece has accepted reforms, including significant pension adjustments, increases to value-added taxes, an overhaul of its collective bargaining system, measures to liberalize its economy, and tight limits on public spending. It has also agreed to sequester 50 billion euros of public assets in a special privatization fund to act as collateral on the deal.
I'd like to see the list of collateral, you know, like the all the incredible Greek monuments, you know.
Oh, come and carry away the Parthenon.
Yeah.
We'll give you the Parthenon.
Well, it'll end up, instead of being owned by the Greek government, it'll be owned by some hedge fund in Wall Street, who will, you know, up the rates for the tourists who want to go there, you know.
Well, I guess, I mean, the question, part of the question is, how did Greece get into such bad shape? How did they get into such debt? Does anybody know? I'm just thinking of how they borrowed a lot of money to put on the Olympics a while back, because they thought it would pay for itself, and it didn't.
Well, they were in deficit in international trading, and the system was loaning money.
That's right.
Yeah.
The system
Goldman Sachs actually put the government to high Greek government debt from the rest of the Eurozone. Goldman Sachs was paid to basically create a scheme whereby the Greeks could get away with debt much higher than than was allowed under the European law.
I thought so.
And you know, this is my thought. You know, we're living in a debt money system. That's what the system is. So eventually you're going to get into debt, because the money is debt. That's how they bail you out, with debt. They bail you out with debt. It's crazy. And you're already in trouble, and they're going to give you more debt. And they expect you to get out of it. It's just how the system controls and punishes and threatens, you know. I mean, I feel so bad for the Greek people. Oh my God. I mean, I said that to a couple of people yesterday. I said, well, we're next. You don't know who's going to be next, but you know it's going to happen, you know. This is the system we live under.
Mm-hmm.
Brutal system. I'll do the next one. The Greek deal. In the European Monetary Union, is the money system the servant or the master? That's the question. Yeah. It's not there to serve the people.
No.
We'll do the next one.
Seven, the stated goals and comments. Article 2 is the human face of the EMU, for it is not obvious or even desirable to all that the money system must be held accountable to foster desirable results. Comment in Article 2 is embodied a silent but important monetary principle. The correct vision that the money system must be managed to produce superior living results, not just to conform to dead theory. That's Darlinga 643. Modified Maastricht Treaty Principle Article 2. To promote, this is how I guess he wants to modify. To promote.
No, this is how it's been modified.
Oh, it's. Okay.
This is from the modified Maastricht Treaty.
Okay. To promote throughout community a harmonious, balanced development of economic activities, sustainable and non-inflationary growth, respecting the environment, the high level of employment and of social production, the raising of the standard of living and quality of life, and economic and social cohesion and solidarity among member states. Well, modified treaty article 105. One, the primary objective of the ESCB shall be to maintain price stability. Without prejudice to objectives of price stability, the ESCB shall support the general economic policies in the community with a view to contributing to the achievement of the objectives of the community as laid down in Article 2.
Contributing, it has to be fixed.
Which one?
Contributing.
Oh, contributing. If you're contributing, I'll change that, yeah. So, there are two things in this treaty. There's the goal of promoting harmonious and balanced development, right? Raising standards of living, quality of life. And then there's the other part that says, well, we have to have price stability. You know, which is it going to be?
So out with harmonious community.
Well, look at Greece. Look what they've done to the Greek people.
It looks as though they're intent on following Article 105, but then paying no attention to Article 2.
Paying no attention.
Yeah.
No attention. That they would be.
It strikes me this is similar to what the Fed did after the crash and in the 1930s. You know, the Fed was supposed to be there as a lender of last resort, blah, 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 and they didn't do it. And it seems to me that the ECB is doing exactly the same thing in Europe right now.
Yes. When they want to, they can do it. But they don't want to. Whoever's in charge.
You know, and in Southern Europe, you have a depression as deep as the Great Depression in the 1930s.
Right, and what they're doing to Greece is a warning to all the other Eurozone countries. It's a warning to them. And do the next one.
Treaty of Maastricht, Article 107. Neither the ECB nor a national central bank nor any member of their decision-making bodies shall seek or take instructions from community institutions or bodies, from any government of a member state, or from any other body. The community institutions and bodies and the governments of the member states undertake to respect this principle and do not seek to influence the members of the decision-making bodies of the ECB or of the national central banks in the performance of their tasks. And comment, is the ECB prohibited from reciprocal influence attempts on the member states? Are the political implications already embodied in the banker-promoted economic and monetary theories that will guide the ECB going to be honestly acknowledged for all to understand?
Yeah, the effect of money on the political is that it controls the politics and the economy, both. So the treaty talks about, well, the political institutions should not influence the ECB, but they don't talk about the other way around. Yeah.
That's a very good point.
Yep. Well, that's one of our of Zarlanga's themes, right? Whoever controls the money controls the society. Not being talked about here. I'll do the next one. Stephen Zarlanga, page 644. The ECB appears superior to the Federal Reserve System. Consider, for example, the public ownership of it and its broad statement of social goals, which have no counterpart in the Federal Reserve. It sounds superior. I don't know if its results are superior. What it's done to Greece just now. We'll do the next one.
This is from Zarlinga, page 644, warning. The ECB does not stop an overly technocratic approach to running the money system without enough thought and detail written provisions for the human, social, and economic requirements. What does that mean? The system working is so efficient that there's not to be human input. Price stability is what runs it.
Right, and the technocratic approach. You know, oh, it's running so efficiently. This is great.
It's killing people.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
It's efficient.
It works. Yeah.
I mean, you know, look it. Your debt is more than 100% over GDP. Oh, you got to cut everything. That's how, you know, it's... I can see it in the figures here. That's it. Let's not look at the people. Technocrats. Someone said that in the last class. We saw a picture of one of the committees of the ECB. One of the executive committees of the ECB. And someone in our class said, oh, those are the technocrats. And do the next one.
And this is Stephen Zarlenga again. Price stability, if achieved through overly restricting the growth in the money supply, will favor wealthy bondholders at the expense of both industrialists and the less well-off, increasing the gulf between rich and poor, based rather on one group controlling the money system, measuring and proclaiming the success of that system in terms specially designed to favor itself. And we have, there's price stability, a well-running machine, and then we have the system is working, I'm getting rich. The rich person is getting rich, and all the poor people are up in the air.
I mean, isn't that what we're fed every day on the media? You know,
but that illustration is wrong.
Yeah.
When you have so many people, it should go down, and that would put him, the banker, on top.
That's true. It should be the opposite way.
Yes.
Oh, that's interesting.
Misillustrated.
I'll have to see if I can find another one. But I think what he says is true, you know. It's like, you read the business news, you know, and everything is working great as long as people are making money, as if that's the only thing going on in the world, the only effect of the system. If that's the effect that they want. I'll do the next one. Zarlenga, page 645. The European Community's approach to monetary union, carefully deliberating the matter, publishing and then reworking its articles with informed input from many quarters and nationalities, is unique in the history of monetary reforms. Okay, so over on the left you have the deception of the signing of the Bank of England Charter. William Paterson, one of the founders, said, all this while, the very name of a bank or corporation was avoided, though the notion of both was intended. So there's a lot of deception. Over on the right is the deception of the creation of the Federal Reserve on Jekyll Island by a group of bankers, one of which was Frank Vandalip, president of National City Bank. And he said, despite my views about the value to society of greater publicity for the affairs of corporations, there was an occasion near the close of 1910 when I was as secretive, indeed as furtive, as any conspirator. I do not feel it is any exaggeration to speak of our secret expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System. I have to move that up. But I'll tell you, I don't think the results of the European Monetary Union are that much greater than these others, you know. But again, Stephen wrote this book, published 2002, and the EU was very young.
Yeah.
It hadn't gone through all of these debt crises, mm-hmm. you know. So, we'll do the next one.
This is still page 645. The European Community's approach to monetary union, carefully deliberating the matters, publishing and then reworking its articles with informed input from many quarters. numbers and nationalities that meet in the history of monetary reforms. You got a cartoon that says, a robot says, I don't want a nation of thinkers, I want a nation of workers.
John D. Rockefeller.
It was John D. Rockefeller. Okay. What do you think? Let me get something out of the way here. What do you think control over the education and national media by the money power can destroy democratic society? Evidence for this is the ignorance of the public of the history of money and the understanding of water.
Where it comes from.
Yeah,
I have to correct that.
Okay.
Yeah. Oops. Where it comes from.
Yeah.
The people who think they are free are really not free, something like that. You know, if you're educated to believe you're free, but they're teaching you you're free.
Mm-hmm.
It's not. Yeah. But you're not. Yeah.
Well, I think we kind of do have a nation of workers, people who are technocrats or who do some kind of repetitive mechanical job, and maybe that's all they're capable of.
We have to stay focused, and Martin's gone, and we just can't even look up. We gotta get that paycheck at the end of the week.
That's right.
We need that job.
Yeah.
And I have
the
potential obsession with price stability is one problem. The system must avoid ideological rigidity. These trouble signs can be substantially reduced by clarification of the fiat nature of money as a legal institution of the community, of the initial guidelines that the ECB will use in making increases in the money supply. These are not matters that should be left vague or couched in overly concise technical jargon. What is money? Where does it come from?
Well, this is not explained to the Eurozone.
No.
In the Eurozone's treaties. This is Stephen talking.
Yeah.
I'll do the next one. So Lange 645. The attempt to disconnect the money system from politics reflects a distrust of the citizenry. It must also be accountable, and it is through politics that the citizens express indirectly whether the money system is functioning well or not. The reason for being, reason for being, of the money system is to serve the community, and history gives us little reason to place more trust in money systems controlled by elites rather than by the citizens. If anything, the balance of monetary history indicates the opposite. For instance, the American colonial legislatures issued debt-free money. Lycurgus of Sparta instituted the first fiat public money in the 8th century BC, which lasted for 3.5 centuries. And Lincoln's greenbacks were public debt-free money that circulated up to 1971, all of which worked very well. Debt-free.
Those ancient Greek leaders were unique in that they elected to serve because they were thinking, what can we do to fix that and make that work? At this kind, they were interested in how to govern to make things work for people.
That's right.
They were genuinely interested in coming up with policies and programs, and he made some funny decisions, but he really was trying to make it work.
Well, his public fiat money lasted for 3.5 centuries.
Yeah.
And every time I read that, I think someone should really investigate what was necessary for it to last for 3.5 centuries? Because we have to, as monetary reformers, we have to think, well, if we get our reform in, what's going to keep it in? That's as important as getting it in. Who's going to guard it and guard that knowledge and make sure that knowledge is given to this, every generation of the citizenry? Mm-hmm. And he did it. His reform, somehow they organized the Spartan community. That money reform. We'll do the next one.
Faced with monetary independence, European monetary independence, some really bad people may attempt a form of military domination instead. Possibility is raised because NATO, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, appears to be emerging as a vehicle for such dominance. These elements could be characterized as an Anglo-American establishment comprising the worst elements from both countries. Let's see, you have NATO, the organization constitutes a system of collective defense whereby its member states agree to mutual defense in response to an attack by an external party. Let's look at the definition. And NATO's 1999 war on Serbia, is this collective defense? That was awful what we did.
They've done worse since then, but that was so, so brutal. And NATO's supposed to be a system of collective defense.
Yeah.
And the rest are simply some charts to show the Euro results thus far through to the current day. So this is the GDP growth rate, and you can see the world economic crisis after 2008, you know, went way down. But the growth has been up and down, right? The next one is the money supply M1, which is the actual euros, actual money. It's gradually increased. And the last one is the euro money supply M2, which is short-term time deposits plus the euros, and that's also increased. And that's as much as I could learn about the euro in this chapter. I feel there's a lot to learn.